So in thinking about this sutta that is the basis for the talks of the retreat, I've been thinking that we humans often believe in fear more than we believe in love. And often we believe in hostility more than we believe in love. Often we believe in being right and in our opinions, then we believe in love. And what would happen if we lived in a world where we believed in love more than those other things? What would happen to you if you believed in love more than fear? That every time you were afraid, you remembered that love is more useful. Every time you felt like you wanted to kind of get back at someone, you remember that love is more effective. And every time you wanted to insist on your point of view, you remembered that love is often more effective. So in this discourse that it begins with these monks who are quarreling and disputing and stabbing each other with verbal daggers. And when the Buddha talks to them, he has this very interesting line. He says, "What can you possibly know and what can you see that you take to quarreling and brawling and are deep in disputes?" What can you possibly know and what can you see? In my own way of saying that, I would say, what could you possibly believe that you think it's valuable, important to be arguing and brawling deep in disputes? What do you believe? What do you believe in that you believe that you should be there, in there, brawling with people, quarreling? Now remember, the context for this is that they were quarreling over how much water was in or wasn't in a little outhouse water dipper. So in that context, he was saying this, but I think it's this idea is applicable in many circumstances in our life. What do we believe in that we rush to judgment? What do we believe in that we maybe get involved in arguments or hostility or anger? One of the great teachings I received from Ajahn Amaro, a monk that some of you know, Englishman, who lived in California for many years. And he came to a retreat that I was at many years ago. He was kind of a guest teacher. He gave this one instruction, which I thought was great, carried with me ever since. He said, the only instruction he gave was, set yourself at ease. And I think he meant whatever modicum of ease that was available to you. Set yourself at ease. And then notice what takes you away from that. That was it. So I think very important for that was the second part, the noticing, the learning, the paying attention, starting to know how you work. What do? That gets you entangled, gets you contracted, gets you agitated. What do you do that gets you kind of builds up some inner pressure or fear or anger or whatever it might be? What do? Because a lot of the Dharma has to do not about understanding enlightenment or bliss or some great states of attainment. A lot of the Dharma is understanding how you work and how you get caught. And by understanding how you get caught, then you have a realistic sense of how to be not caught. And if you're not caught, that's pretty good. if you're at ease or not caught, then there's a fairly good chance that you can take the time to, or the to have the vision to value and affirm people, to value and affirm each other, to value and affirm yourself. When we're caught and entangled, it's hard, there's not much space to do that. And so in this dispute, and that these monks, you know, they were arguing in such a way that there was no, when you're stabbing people with verbal daggers, there's not much valuing each other, not much appreciation and affirming of people, their value, and there's not much. And so the Buddha asked this question, in my paraphrase, what do you possibly believe in that you're doing this? And then he teaches them the six principles of cordiality. And, you know, we have, some of us who are in this Buddhist field, struggle a little bit with Buddhist English. And here this word cordiality, I think, is a Buddhist English, because the only time I use, I don't know, what, maybe you guys use English differently than me, but the only time I use the word cordial, like the person, they were cordial to each other, it's not really good news. So you're laughing, so I guess it's, you know, other people share that idea. So cordiality, well, gee, you know. I guess we'll be civil with each other. And as I said the other day, we don't quite know how to translate the original word, but one of the meanings could be that it means heartwood, like the essence of something, the heartwood of something. And and I love that somehow these are the six, and the word is six dhammas. So dharma is a powerful word too, but here maybe qualities of heart, inner qualities, and those qualities are heartwood. And wouldn't it be nice, at least it would be nice if these six things were our heartwood, like our essence, that kind of held us up, made us strong, like heartwood makes a tree strong. Heartwood is also, I think, where the nourishment for the tree flows. So these would nourish us, perhaps, the heartwood. And so six qualities of heartwood, of support for us. And the first three, first two is what you heard, was to maintain acts of loving kindness publicly and privately. To maintain acts, to act that way with your body. The second is to do it with your words, verbal acts of loving kindness. And so the third, some of you know a little bit about Buddhism, it has to be with the mind. So mental acts of loving kindness privately and publicly. So that's what I'll talk a little bit about today. So the first three of these six principles have to do with metta. And all six of them, one of their functions is to create love and respect, cohesion, non-dispute, concord, and unity. Great things, right? These are all ways of being together in society and community. And to live in community with love, and I like it that at least in English it says love and respect. To really respect each other. I think to have love without respect makes it maybe, I don't know what it makes it, but maybe it's not, maybe could become sentimental, maybe it could, it's easily with, you know, too much sentimental love to kind of lose touch with the person that we're, you know, in relationship with, you know. Some people are in love with love, and that's a little bit dangerous, you know, just, oh, we're supposed to be, you know, just, there's a policy of love or a policy of trying to be kind, and I've been the recipient of kindness from people where, you know, you realize I'm here? It was nice that they were doing these nice things, but, you know, they didn't feel like, it was felt like more like their policy or their practice rather than anything to do with me. But to have the respect together with love, I think makes it somehow, maybe adds heartwood to it, makes it strong or makes it real or something, because then you're really connected to the people you're with. And we thought maybe it'd be nice to let you know what the last three are, what's coming. Sort of keep you on the edge of your seats, you know. So you'll come back, you know, and it gets more exciting. The fourth one is sharing what you have with others. So generosity, but sharing what you have with others. The fifth one is living a virtuous life, having ethical integrity, and it has a particular twist about how this nature of these ethics here, and you'll see in a couple of days. And then surprisingly, remember all six of these lead to love, respect, concord, unity, harmony, all these things. And the last one is maybe this would seem a little surprising. The last one is maintaining, having, I'll read it to you. The person has that view that is noble and liberating and that leads to the complete destruction of suffering. So this, it might seem like it's very personal, you know, having a view that's liberating, at least the complete destruction of suffering. That's, you know, just for me, right? Or just for you as a person, as an individual. And maybe that's selfish, right, to do that. You know, just focus on yourself. You should go out there and kind of forget about yourself and just serve other people. That's a message from some people have. But here, this is a kind of a progression in a sense, and this is considered the highest of these six. But this, too, is a principle or cordiality that creates love and respect and conduces to cohesion, to non-dispute, to concord, and to unity. So there's something about freeing your heart that can be done or is done for the sake of our society as a whole. We don't just do it for ourselves. So for today, the Buddha says, one maintains mental acts of loving kindness, both in public and in private, towards one's companions in the holy life. This too is a principle of cordiality that creates love and respect. So here it's worded towards one's companions in the holy life. He was talking to monastics who are arguing. So he was talking about doing it in the monastic community itself. We could then apply that to ourselves here. We're living the so-called holy life here during this week, the practice life. And so to maintain mental thoughts, mental attitudes of loving kindness towards your companions here. But, you know, I think it's important to see the whole world as our companions. And so how do we have loving kindness, goodwill, friendliness to the world itself around us? So one of the things that I've learned through doing this practice, at least for myself, and I hope it's true for others, is that the most valued thing we have, the most precious thing we have, is the quality of our own heart, the quality of our mind. It's more important than, more valuable, more treasure than anything else. Remember a little story of, I had gone to Nepal to practice with Upandita. He was a Burmese teacher who was going to visit Nepal. And it was hard, I had trouble getting to Burma to practice, so I heard that he was going to be in Nepal, so I went for a month to practice with him there. And while I was waiting for him to come, I wandered around for a day or two in the streets of Kathmandu, and they have these little shops, Buddha shops with Buddhist art and statues, and I saw one that was, I never went in them, but I got to stood in front of the window of one of them, and there was a Buddhist statue that I was really taken by, and I really would like that, and that would be really nice. And I'd go back to the store again, look in the window, and go back and look at the window, and I don't remember how much it was, but it was something like $100 or $200. But I had gone to Asia to be there for, you know, however long. I had a one-way ticket. And I think I had, by that time, I probably had $1,000 for the duration. So that was a big chunk of money, $100, $200 for the statue. And so I was wondering, what should I do? And then it dawned on me, as much as this Buddha statue was lovely and meaningful, spoke to me in some way, that the most beautiful thing that I know is a pure mind or a pure heart. That's like, you know, the most beautiful thing that I know in the whole universe. Look at the night sky, look at sunsets. Nothing is as wonderful as a heart that's pure. And so the next thing I thought was, I'll save this money, not spend it on the Buddha, but I'll help someone else to practice. So that was a nice, I thought that was a nice thought. And then a day later or so, I called my girlfriend in Berkeley. I called her roommates, and her roommates answered, and they said, can I talk to Rosie? And they said, she's on her way to Kathmandu to be with you. Aside from the fact that she had no idea where to find me in Kathmandu. There was no address, no nothing, right? Kathmandu is a big place. Where are you supposed to find me? Then I kept that money. So she had less money than me. So then I used that. I had money to support her when she came, so to, in her practice. She was coming to practice too. So the most beautiful thing we have is our heart, the quality of our hearts. And for the Buddha, he said that, you know, monastics are not supposed to have money. They're not supposed to have wealth. But he said, wealth for monastics is loving kindness. Wealth for monastics is their metta, their goodwill. That's, you know, gives a pretty high value for this thing, this goodwill. So it's something we can cultivate. And one of the ways to cultivate it is to value it. And don't underestimate how important it is to value something. Value some aspect of yourself, value other people, value things of other people. Because there's something about what we value tends to be what gets fed, what grows. So if you value some good qualities in other people, it kind of helps that to grow and be appreciated and kind of have time for. If you value something in yourself, then that can grow and develop. So if what you value the most is your neurosis, watch out. If you value your resentments, you know, that has a certain kind of trajectory. But if you value goodwill, if you value respecting people, if you value generosity, if you value these good qualities of us, then that has a chance to grow and develop. And what's nice about the word valuing, it doesn't mean you have to have it. You don't have to have goodwill to value it. But just valuing it is helpful. I mean, the art of it is how to value it and not be upset with yourself for not having it. So it's very important to value that you're valuing it. Appreciate that you're one of those people who sees value in these good qualities, because these ways of relating, these attitudes. So one way is to value goodwill, and that's part of this inner mental side of having goodwill, is to value it. And that can be done publicly and privately. Publicly, I take it to mean just valuing, respecting, affirming the people you know, run into. And privately, maybe means just inside yourself, both for yourself, but also within yourself, you can value other people. And I'm very fond of this sutta's way of talking about public and private, or inner and outer, whatever it means. Because I find it a lot easier to have goodwill for people if I don't have to show it. Because it gets complicated sometimes if you have to show it and be it and do it, and you know, and it's not always appropriate to have goodwill for everyone, you know, because, you know, some people maybe are trying to take advantage of you, or, you know, some people are not very kind, or, you know, some people you want to, it's pretty wise to keep your distance from some people, you know, but you could still have goodwill privately. As I walk away, I really wish you well. Occasionally that happens, you know. You know, it's not the time for it or something. So I feel much more, it's easier, it's less complicated if I don't have to, it doesn't have to actually be enacted in the real world, because it gets complicated, you know. It's hard to understand the world, hard to understand people and the dynamics. And so, and I know sometimes that's the hesitation to have goodwill, is because of the complications it pulls us into. Not a few people I know will have said something like, well, if I stop and talk to a homeless person, then I'm going to have to invite them home. You know, and they're afraid of that. You know, I can't get that involved and that close. Maybe or maybe not, I don't know. But you can at least, you know, hold them in your heart in a kind way, in a generous way, and with respect, and the way that values everyone, whoever you meet. And then maybe you can at some day or some point, maybe you can act. We want to live in a world where we act in our goodwill. But I think it counts a lot to just kind of cultivate a heart that has goodwill, cultivate an inner life that's a habit, that's a tendency, that's what flows from us. And I think knowing you don't have to do it out loud, you know, can be easier to cultivate and develop. Something I also learned from doing this practice is what a drag it is to have resentments. What a drag it is to judge people, you know, in some critical way. What a drag it is to you know, be afraid of people. What a drag it is to kind of, what it does for us, especially inside. And so, I mean, sometimes it's appropriate to be afraid of others. Sometimes it's appropriate to evaluate and assess and decide that this is not going well, this is not right, for sure. But we have that capacity to do these things as human beings, because it's useful, probably keeps us alive to do this. But sometimes we do the useful things too much. It's like brushing your teeth is good, right? But it wouldn't be good if that's all you did all day. So judging is good at times, but if all you did was judge, I don't think it's so good. So one of the things I've learned is that by being mindful and seeing what the impact is on me of my thoughts and my attitudes and what I do internally, and seeing that it's a drag, it kind of dampens my energy, it kind of closes me up, it creates distance between me and other people. And slowly I've learned that to not pick some things up, because it's just not interesting. So it's sort of like the tendency to judge people. And so a place that it takes that's I find interesting, and hopefully you don't think it's alarming, is I periodically meet people who have done something unethical. in the clearest place, you know, sometimes I meet people and I go to prison and meet people there, and they've done unethical things for sure. There's no way of getting around what they've done. But even, you know, in our communities and just around, I meet people. And sometimes I have a role to evaluate what's going on. Like, I'm on an ethics committee, so I have a role to consider it deeply and reflect on it and assess and evaluate and do things. But sometimes I meet people who do things unethical, and it serves absolutely no purpose whatsoever for me to judge them. I mean, it just, like, it's not my role, it's not my place, it's not going to have any purpose or effect on people. It's not going to change the course of human history in any way. You know, they're just, I'm sitting next to them on the bus or something, I'm just with them some way. And so why should I judge them for what they've done? Why should I bother? Why should I use my precious brain energy to, you know, I don't believe in what this person did. This is not right. I should give this person a piece of my mind, because, or something. I find it just, it's a drag for me. I mean, I was having a good time driving on the, going on the bus, looking out the window, and this person sat down next to me, and we were having a conversation, and now I get to kind of like, how could there be a person like that? Look what they did. You know, why? The person can get off at the next bus stop, you know, and they're going to see the person again. So why? Like, sure. And then I go home to my wife. Let me tell you who I sat next to on the bus. And then she gets all around. Oh, there's all people in the world. I was having a perfectly good day looking at the bus. But being and telling other people about those people. It's a way of bonding, right? Like, oh, like, we're right, we're the right people, we know better, and it's you know, it must be fun for some people to but it's a drag for me. So this thing about so sometimes these you know, people do unethical things, I find it just better for me, healthier for me, and I think it's healthier for them to not judge, to just be there. This is a person. If they ask me, what do you think about me having robbed the local bank? Then I'll tell them, I don't think that's a good idea. But they're not asking me. They're getting off at the next bus stop. If they're carrying the loot in their bag, then maybe I'd do something. But, you know, this happened, you know, a long time ago. And so you get the idea? I hope you get the idea. I hope you don't think I'm too strange. So if it's true for those circumstances, you know, something done unethical, it's also true for a lot of other things that we do. You know, we carry with us all these judgments, these ideas, and all this stuff. And how often is it useful to do that? To put a question mark behind, is this really kind of, does it serve me? Does it serve other people? Is it really the most effective way of creating safety, effective way of being, of growing and developing, and is it? Sometimes it might be, but often it isn't. How do we become the caretakers of the quality of our own hearts? And what I'm trying to say here is one of the ways of thinking about it, so that yes, you start taking, your quality of your heart is precious, it's your wealth. If you can stay at ease, if you can stay with respect and love in your heart, that is great, to value that. And then to have thoughts, attitudes, well-wishing of others. So your heart kind of sings in a certain way, sings with delight in the people you come across, rather than singing in fear or judgment, or sing in delight. You don't have to share your song with people. But these people are wonderful. It's amazing. And that's another thing I feel this practice has done for me over the years. It came as a surprise. You know, I was kind of a little bit, you know, of the individualism school. So I was just kind of stumbled into practice because I thought it was just nice, good thing to do for myself. And you go into the water and come out in the fire, or vice versa. So I went in through the individual door of practice, and I came out in community. And one of the great things was to discover to have the ability, have a kind of a way of looking, perhaps, that just somehow just sees everyone as being beautiful, being wonderful. It's like a spark of life. It's a funny thing, you know, how human beings, we can go walking in the forest and be in awe at all the oak trees that are growing there, even though some of them grow in all kinds of odd ways. Some branches go this way and that way, and they don't regulate them very well themselves very much. You know, they don't follow the prototypical form of how oak trees are supposed to grow. You know, I have a picture in my encyclopedia, and I haven't found that tree yet. You know, there are all these different kinds of oak trees, but we go in the forest. Like, all the oak trees are great. Do you go into the supermarket? All these people are great. Wow, look at this. If you can do it for oak trees, why can't you do it for people? What do we do? What do we add on top of it? What goes on in our minds that we go into the supermarket and we can't just appreciate what people are doing there? I love going into supermarkets because I don't do it very often. But I kind of like it when the supermarket is crowded. Like if you go on Sunday or something, Safeway. Because I feel like I'm being connected to a kind of, not exactly timeless, but a millennia-old human kind of phenomena of people who live in kind of urban or village settings, the bazaar. And I've been to third world countries where they still have the old world bazaars. And they tend to be crowded, and people are haggling, and you have to kind of bounce around people and kind of dodge them, and they're carrying things, and they're yelling, and it feels like life and vitality, and people taking care of their families and their livelihood and finding their way and talking and sharing their community life, and it's like so, at least in my eyes, so enriching, so valuable. So I get to go to Safeway. And it's our bazaar, and everybody's like going around, and I like it when I have to dodge people there, when people are blocking the lanes, because it's like the bazaar, it's like what people have been doing for millennia. And I just love these people. Wow, they're all doing their life, doing the best they can, and it isn't so great. And then since I'm kind of an introvert, it's so great because, different than the bazaar, no one's talking to me. I get the best of all worlds here. So to appreciate people and to have your heart open, and what do we see? When we look out through our eyes, what do we see? Ajahnamurro said, set yourself at ease and notice what takes you away from it. Set yourself in love, set yourself in goodwill, and notice what takes you away from it. So what do you see when you look at other people, when you go into the supermarket, or you go, or here at IRC? What do you see when you see people? Do you see a threat? Do you see an object of desire? Do you see an obstacle? Do you see a supporter? Do you see, you know, what do you see? And how do you, what's your basic kind of attitude? What do you see? Do you see people who are wearing the wrong color socks? And people should, they should have sent out a letter to from IRC before we came, and letting everyone know the right color socks to wear. How could they wear socks like that? I have the socks these days that have this puma cat over the top, you know. How could you let a Dharma teacher come to a retreat center and have a puma cat on top of their socks? I mean, I mean, this is undignified for the Dharma, so we'll probably get a letter soon. So, you know, what do you see? What are you looking at? You know, what are the eyes that, you know, going out, and what do you pick up? And what do you, how do you, and what does that do to you and your relationship? And is there love in that kind of way of seeing? Is there goodwill? Is there appreciation and respect? It was an important moment in my life, or not a moment, but a few days, weeks, was when I was 19, I went to Morocco. And I'd never, it was the first time I'd been outside a Western country as an adult. And this was 1973. So in Morocco, I don't know what it's, I haven't been back since, but much of the traditional culture of Morocco was still there, as far as I could tell, in some parts of it. And I noticed as I walked, spend my days there, that I had a certain lightness in my mind, ease in my mind that I was unfamiliar with. I thought, this is kind of strange. I wonder what this is. So I went around and wondered what it was. And then I decided what it was that when I walked through the streets and the bazaars of Marrakesh and different places, a lot of the people wore their traditional clothes. It's like the men wore these yalabas, these long gowns. And all the categories that I had for placing people in, you know, in who they were, you know, judgments, you know, like that I had here in America, didn't apply, because they weren't wearing a business suit, they weren't, you know, wearing, having long hair, they weren't, you know, a jock, they weren't, you know, all these things that I put people in their little pigeonhole and then had attitudes and opinions about people based on who they were. None of it computed. You know, it just didn't. So I didn't have any, that functioning of the mind wasn't happening. And so I had this more lightness and ease because I wasn't laying this thing on people with my mind. So that was a great thing to discover, to see what I do, what I add on top of people. So what do you see when you see people? So the Buddha said, cultivate public and private. Let me see, get it right. Maintain mental acts of loving kindness, both in public and in private. So, I don't know what it means to do mental acts publicly. But I think people pick up. I think that if you have an attitude of respect for people, an attitude of kindness, I think it's kind of, can be felt and kind of be recognized and known. And then the important question for many of us is, how do we have that attitude of respect and kindness and love for others, and how do we keep ourselves safe in a situation? And I appreciated Marlena's question this morning about the clinging, and I was thinking about it during the course of the day, and wanted to mention I think it's very important for people doing Buddhist practice to realize, because we get sometimes the wrong impression from Buddhism. It's not a sin to cling. It's not a sin. It just hurts. But it's not a sin, and so it's okay if you cling. I mean, it's not like the end of the world. And if you happen to be clinging and you know, if you need to clean your kitchen and you happen to be clinging at it, you still get it clean. So you can have love and goodwill and have it a little bit complicated. Maybe there is some clinging. But hopefully we know enough not to let the clinging get the upper hand. To believe in love more than clinging. To believe in love more than anger. To believe in love more than fear. To believe in love more than our self-concern or self-pity. To believe in love more than our egotism. to believe in love more than our self-centeredness, something like that. So, that's all good and sweet. And if that's the only thing we say, then, you know, it's a little bit dangerous. One of the dangerous things about Buddhist culture, is that the idea that we're supposed to be kind people, supposed to have metta and love for each other. And then what often happens in Buddhist communities is that people's anger to each other, people's anger especially, oh, I can't show that, not in the Buddhist scene, because we're all supposed to be kind and good. And so there's a tendency for anger and conflict also to go into the shadow, to be swept away and not looked at. And I've been in enough Buddhist communities to know the suffering that happens when people become conflict avoidant because they think they're supposed to be kind. So I like it that these monks, a little bit that they were in dispute. And really, also I liked, you know, it's unfortunate they were disputing over what seemed to me like a silly old thing, the water in a little dipper. But what I really liked more is that the Buddha calls them over and says, are you guys like arguing and disputing and stabbing each other with verbal daggers? And it's like one of the primo parts of the sutta. They say, yes. That honesty, that willingness to put it all out there and be, you know, have it public, you know, put it all on the table. Yeah, yes, this is what's going on. And because then there's hope for us if we're kind of, you know, yes, there will be conflict. Yes, there will be anger. And but to not hide it, not give into it. But and if discover effective ways to let it be known. So, like, I like the expression, put it on the table. Because for me, what that means is that, like, if two people are angry with each other, or I'm angry with someone, putting on the table means I'm making it visible, but I'm not directing it at you. I'm not hiding it, but it's there for both of us to look at. Let's put it on. Put it all on the table. And that also, I think, to know how to be in conflict with others, while we maintain our respect for them, while we maintain our goodwill, is one of the great practices to try to find. And one of the things I've learned how to do it, because it's difficult to do sometimes, is the importance of being with them, in their directly in contact with them. Because I've seen, maybe some of you also have seen this, but I've seen that, you know, I could have some grudges, the earthing. And if I don't see them, if I'm not around them, then it kind of enters into the world of my fantasy, my imagination, and, you know, it's all, you know, the whole thing is happening from my point of view, and my image of them and what I think happened. And but if I can get myself in front of them and have a conversation with them, I discover that I can't live anymore in my imagination of what it's all about. And then there becomes a real person there, and it becomes a real, much richer thing to do. So when I find myself with a grudge or anger or challenge by some person, then I try to figure out a way where we can meet, because it helps me so that I see a person there. So this is all part, I think, of living and acts of goodwill, is to be willing to kind of be interested in trying to show up, be interested in trying to live with everything out on the table, so we can all find our way with it. Conflict is the way that we find our way. Conflict is the way that, as a community, we grow and develop. It's not wrong to have conflict, but don't specialize in it. but when it's there, kind of you let it grow. Let him talk about it and put it on the table. And that makes the whole Buddhist emphasis on loving kindness safer, more realistic. Because then, you know, then certain things don't get pushed into the shadow of this community. And also that we don't want things in the shadow of our own minds. And that's one of the great things about mindfulness practice, sitting here on retreat, is that mindfulness is kind of like the practice of pulling the curtain from everything. So whatever is in your heart, sooner or later will have a chance to surface. Because we want everything on the table of our heart. And so whatever is in there, to have the confidence, the trust, the willingness to let whatever is happening in you to come forward. Because you're just as important as anybody else. And what's in your heart and what you're struggling with is just as important as anybody else's life. You're a very important person. And so it's a very respectful and loving thing for oneself to practice mindfulness, that just willing to be present and open to what's here now, just whatever it is, the sound of a traffic, an itch, an irritation, a pleasant breath, the nice taste of the food, the impatience of standing in the dishwashing line, whatever it might be, just be present and open for this, whatever it is. If you do that, then sooner or later, all the different things of your life will come to you and find you that you need to address and be with. So the image of, you know, if you go to the savannas of Africa and hang out at the watering hole, sooner or later all the animals will come and visit you, the watering hole at least. So if you sit with your mindfulness, sooner or later everything you need to address will come up. But the whole range of who you are, the good, the bad, and the ugly is good. And you don't know what's working through you. You don't know what's in that opening to that, what's coming through, what needs to come through. And you know, after hearing talks for 3 days on metta, and you're just sitting there resentful, and then you feel lousy. Boy, these teachers, you know, I guess I came to the wrong retreat. The 3 days of resentment could be just what the doctor ordered. Who knows what you don't know what's coming through you. So I wanted to read, bring this to an end here, a wonderful passage from this was written by a French philosopher in 1753. Diderot, maybe his name. Having strayed into an immense forest during the night, I have only a small candlelight to guide me. I come across a stranger who says to me, "My friend, blow out your candle in order to better find your way. Blow out your candle in order to better find your way." And then he says, the stranger is a theologian. I don't know in the 1700s what a theologian meant, but in the 2000, it's the Dharma teacher. Sometimes you have to let it go dark to find your way. Because your little candle kind of blinds you to the wider what you see, and so you can see better without that light sometimes. Or my son was given a poem. They had to recite it once a week all year for, I think it was fifth grade, I think it was. And he recited it once a week at school. Stand up in front of the class, and everyone had their verse, and he had his verse, and his verse was, "Without darkness, nothing comes to life. Without light, nothing blossoms. So we need darkness. We need light. And so sometimes we come to this retreat and we go in through the darkness and come out to the light. Sometimes we come here and we go in through light and come out through the darkness. So if it's difficult while you're here, maybe that's the light. Maybe that's the darkness. We don't know. But you don't know what's working in you. So this wonderful practice of ours of being still, being present, being in a certain kind of way quiet, to hear, sense, smell, feel, touch our life here within ourselves. What's here? What's here? And kind of get out of the way of yourself to let what's here flow and show itself. And don't worry about whether it's good, bad, or ugly. It's a waste of your time to judge yourself. It's okay to be who you are. Let it come, let it come. And I think in that ease and freedom of letting yourself be who you are, then we have a good chance to have some kind of genuine love and respect for ourselves and the world around us. And then we blow out the candle, whatever candle you've been gripping, and then you can make yourself, make of yourself a light. Make yourself into a light for the world. And I'll end with a poem by Mary Oliver. The poem is called The Buddha's Last Instruction. Make of yourself a light, said the Buddha, before he died. I think of this every morning as the east begins to tear off its many clouds of darkness to send up the first signal, a white fan streaked with pink and violet, even green. An old man, he lay down between two sala trees, and he might have said anything, knowing it was his final hour. The light burns upward. It thickens and settles over the fields. Around him the villagers gathered and stretched forward to listen. Even before the sun itself hangs, disattached in the blue air, I am touched everywhere by its ocean of yellow waves. No doubt the Buddha thought of everything that had happened in his difficult life. And then I feel the sun itself as it blazes over the hills like a million flowers on fire. Clearly, I am not needed. Yet I feel myself turning into something of inexplicable value. Slowly, beneath the branches, the Buddha raised his head. He looked into the faces of that frightened crowd. Make yourself a light. Make of yourself a light. Perhaps you already are a light. May the light of your heart come forth and shine its beauty for all of us. May sitting here, honest, still, attentive, clear, be the source of light of goodwill and respect and love for our world. Let's take a moment to sit.